श्रीला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरिनाम संकीर्तन की जय, गौर भक्तवृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि वो। प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू, गुड मॉर्निंग। And we are continuing with our series of Istagosti, weekly Istagosti Q&A in English. Today, just in case, I will tell it at the end, but just one brief notification at the beginning as well. This will be the last one of Q&A, weekly Q&A for some time, since in few days I will be traveling to the US and will be sharing with my Guru Maharaj and attending his lectures, and then I will start some tour in the US, giving quite an amount of lectures and Q&A's, so there will be actually more classes and Q&A's than one per week, and that's why I will be not doing this Q&A, but start Q&A in Spanish actually. So just for your information, I will try to remind that at the end. So, okay, I'll begin with one question, and of course if there are any other questions, I think some of them have been shared already by Namarasa, so let's see where we can reach today, since also I have to leave relatively early for some other engagements, but we will try our best. So first of all, I will start with one question that was sent to me by Jugal Kishore Prabhu. So let me check 1 second. So okay, so here it is. It's a question, but there are many, many questions in between. So it's one question, but with many nuanced things. So I will read the whole thing he sent, and let's see what we can say about it. So he mentions, it's in connection to the previous Q&A. Here are some thoughts that came up halfway through your recent discussion on Uttam Bhakti in the context of compassion for others' suffering. So now come the thoughts. Is it right to say not all karma is bad karma? Therefore, when a devotee uses their karma to aspire more towards the spiritual, that can be expressed in the four devotees given in the Gita, or the four D's. I don't understand what they say, but he implies desire for knowledge, desire for gain, desire for freedom from suffering, desire for service. Should these motivating factors be understood in a hierarchical fashion, or are they more or else equal in their capacity for achieving the same results? That's the first part. Then he continues. The desire for the cessation of something seems inherently negative. If this was gone, then I would be better, happier, etc. Compared to the desire for something positive, adding knowledge, adding some material comfort or basic human need, or even adding care of love, i.e. devotional service. So, is the kind of karma acquired with respect the four legs of Dharma is better in setting up a foundation for bhakti to grow from? Or should we understand all karma to be inherently binding and therefore equally negative? Or in some way that the bad, quote-unquote, karma that manifests in loss, in destruction, in happiness and in pain is actually good in that it more quickly cuts through the illusion of safety or satisfaction in the world? So that's basically the question. As you can see, there are many nuances in between that, inside of that. So let's share some thoughts and see where do we land in. So going back to the very beginning of the question, and again, all this is in connection to our previous lecture, previous Q&A last Friday, for those who would like to have further, bigger context and background. So, is it right to say not all karma is bad karma? Well, there are ways of saying, depending who is saying that, of course. If an Uttam Bhakta is speaking, there will be a particular perspective. If some other person is speaking, or you are speaking to other person, some other expression will be there. The Vedas themselves, they will express different things in different ways. Basically, for example, the Vedas are glorifying karma kanda section, the path of karma, indeed. So it has to speak with with like flowery words, if you will, about that. The Gita addresses that concern. Traigunya Vishaya Veda Nistraigunya Babarjuna. Krishna says to Arjuna at what point in the Gita. Actually, the Vedas mostly deal with the three modes, with the three gunas, in this karma kanda, with dharma, artha, kama mostly, which has to do with dharma. Dharma, artha, and kama has to do also with sattva, rajas, tamas. So, transcend all this, this trigunya babarjuna, become transcendental to the gunas, attain a higher stage. But again, there are sections in the Veda that, yeah, karma will be promoted, karma will be glorified, its results will be praised like nothing, swarga, and so on. So for certain people, you won't hear, you shouldn't tell all karma is bad karma, basically. Some people cannot, don't have an ear for that. They're after good karma, of course. Generally, nobody will say, I want to acquire more bad karma and increase my karmic debt. So I go to Potala Loka and something like that. Generally, those who arrive to those places, it's not by voluntary decision, but by force of destiny, by force reaction. You have forced action, but you have forced reaction. But in the case of Swarga, in generally many cases, although in some cases some people may not be pointing to that, but they're extremely sattvic and that their corresponding destiny, but some people really want to achieve that place and work to that effect, and there is a result to that. But again, from the perspective of Uttam Bhakti, with Jnana Karmadi and Abritam, which is unencumbered, the conception is unencumbered by all forms of Jnana and Karma. Yeah, karma, whether you speak in terms of good karma or bad karma, at the end of the day, karma is karma. Whether you say good or bad, the word is karma, and karma means, again, the binding of the soul, the glue, as my Guru Maharaj likes to put, between the Tathastha Shakti and the Maya Shakti. How the two connect with one another, if you will, Maya and Jiva. Karma is the glue, and Anadi Karma, as Krishna says in the Gita, chapter 13, verse 20. Jivas are Anadi, Maya Shakti is Anadi, and therefore the connection between the two is anadi as well. And that's karma. Both Baladev, Vidyabhushan and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur clarify that in the purport. So, from that perspective, yeah, all karma is binding, if you will. Even if you acquire good karma and you go to Swarga, or you go to Brahma Lok, you know, Abrahama Ubanaloka Punarnavartin Arjuna. Mamutatyattu Kantya Punarjanmanavidyate. Only you won't be born again if you go to Krishna's abode. But if you go even to Brahma Lok, if you go higher and higher and higher, nonetheless, you'll have to go down. In other words, as it is said, only planet Earth is the plane where you acquire karma. If you go down planet Earth, you go to pay karma. If you go to higher realms, somehow you are going to reap the fruits of your good karma. But only on this planet, Bhumi Loka, you are acquiring new karma. If you go to Tala, Rasatala, Batala, Sutala, and so on, you are going there to receive the results of your previous bad karma. If you go to Swarga and other heavenly realms, you are going to obtain the results of your good karma. But whether, again, it's bad or good karma, whenever those fruits have been manifested, you go back here to continue and to point towards the real goal, which is not go down, go up on the material scale, but go beyond that, if you will. So that's one way to put it. So then the question continues and invokes the verse of the Gita, which speaks about four types of people who eventually surrender to Krishna's, you know. Chaturbhida vajante mam, artha jignasura, how is it? Chaturbhida vajante mam. Artha jignasura artharti jnani chavaratarsava. One word disappeared from me. Chaturbhida vajante mam. Please, the pandits on the court present there. How the second line? Bhida vajante mam. Jnana sukriti narjuna. Thank you. I mean, nobody told me, but thank you, Paramatma, for reminding me. Chaturbhida vajante mam. Jnana sukriti narjuna. Artha jignasura artharti jnani chavaratarsava. So Krishna is saying four types of people. Worship me, chaturbhida, four types, bhajante mam, engage in bhajan to me. And then he shares something, or approach me and in that sense engaged in bhajan to me. Jnana Sukriti, Jnana Sukriti and Arjuna. And these people, we will call them four types of pious people. Sukriti. Sukriti. And he will say, Artha, Jignasu, Artha, Arti, Jnane. So these are the four types. Artha, the one who is looking for wealth. Jnani, the one. Artha, Jignasu, Jignasu, the one who is inquiring. Artha, Arti, the one who is. Sorry, the one who is afflicted, Artha, the one who is looking for wealth, Jnani, the one who is in knowledge, basically. So Artha, the distressed, again, Artha, the one desiring wealth, Jnasu, the one who is inquiring, and Jnani, the one who has knowledge. So this verse appears in chapter 7 of the Gita, I think verse 14. And some words in that connection, since there are some questions here. Now, the ones who desire all these things, should these motivating factors be understood in a hierarchical fashion, or there are more else equal in the capacity for achieving the same result? First, to begin with, remember that bhaktiya sanjataya bhaktiya. So bhakti comes from bhakti, which means bhakti comes from sadhu sangha. So it doesn't come from piety, from sattva, from inquiring, philosophically only for one wanting what to speak for desiring wealth, fame, and so on. So bhakti is satantric, so it's independent in her movements, and it expresses itself through the medium of the sadhu, and that's the way we can be blessed by the shelter and contact of bhakti or of the Swarup Shakti, basically. So what's this verse? The question is asking: is there any hierarchy in this connection? So Krishna is, in this section of the Gita, and I will mostly refer to the words of the different commentators on this verse as well, that my Guru Maharaj also includes in his version of the Gita. So this verse is mostly speak about Mishra Bhakti, which means mixed devotion, mixed in different directions. It can be mostly Karma Mishra Bhakti or Jnana Mishra Bhakti. So it's important to understand that's not the same thing as Uttam Bhakti. The conception of Uttam Bhakti, again, is Jnana, Karma, Adhyanavritam, unencumbered by both Karma and Jnana. But here, these verses of this type of people, these four people, are mostly, all of them actually, connected with the notion of Mishra Bhakti. So it's some diluted conception there yet, some approach which is not entirely devoid of separate interest or something apart from bhakti for its own sake. It's not anyavilasita sunyam, it's not jnana karma adhyanavritam. So those who are desiring knowledge, of course, also is another way of saying those who are desiring liberation, which sometimes is called yoga misra bhakti. Those who embrace bhakti because they know bhakti will be an active principle to attain mukti. So generally, commentators will mention that three of the four mentioned in this particular verse of the Gita, mostly are in the category of Karma Mishra Bhakti. And you may imagine which ones. Artha, Artha Arti, Artha Jignasura Artha Arti, basically. Artha, the ones who are afflicted. So they approach Krishna, they approach Bhakti, and trying to put some relief to their suffering. So there are some separate interests, if you will. They are not approaching bhakti, again, for bhakti's own sake. Bhaktiya sanjataya bhaktiya, which also means not only bhakti comes from bhakti, but bhakti is approached with the idea for the sake of bhakti. Bhakti comes from bhakti and bhakti produces more bhakti. That's the ideal conception. I obtain bhakti from bhakti's grace, and I embrace and accept in my life bhakti for bhakti's own sake. So distressed, again, Karma Mishra Bhakti. They approach bhakti, so there can be bhaktas, but again, Mishra Bhaktas or Sakam Bhaktas, maybe called devotees with material desires. Artharti, those who desire wealth, they go to God and they ask, give me this, give me that. We know what's that about. Again, Krishna is mercifully saying, at least they come to me, because many people is distressed and is desiring wealth, but resorting to different other so-called shelters, but at least they're coming to me, so I consider them. And as we know, by his mercy, by his acceptance of those who approach him like that, which many, maybe most of us may have that approach as well, gradually we will see the purification, the bhakti itself will purify the conception and make someone realize the ultimacy, the supremacy of Uttam Bhakti. And inquisitive Vijyasu is also considered an example of Karma Mishra Bhakti, someone who is curious, who is wanting knowledge, but not necessarily knowledge in the context of mukti, basically. So there are so many people who is intellectually curious, basically. Chanchala. They cannot remain fixed in one place. They want to know, they want to know, they want to acquire information, to know things. That has not necessarily something to do with going beyond the modes. So he also enters Ignyasu in the category of Karma Mishra Bhakti, devotion with some personal karma. Again, Karma Mishra Bhakti, some fruitive desire, whether in the form of relief of suffering, obtaining relief, obtaining wealth, obtaining knowledge, obtaining information, the wealth of knowledge, if you will. And generally the jnani depicted in this verse, the fourth person, is connected to the other type of Mishra Bhakti, Jnana Mishra Bhakti. That's why it's a jnani. Jnani is someone who is approaching bhakti for jnanas, jnana's sake, or the fruit of jnana, which is moksha or mukti. At least this is the opinion of Baladev Vidyabhushan. And his commentary, for example, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, when he explains these sections in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he has a slightly different opinion, and he divides these four into two categories, and he considers the distressed and the one desiring wealth, Artha, Artharthi, as belonging to Karma Mishra Bhakti, and Jignyasu and Jnani as belonging to Jnana Mishra Bhakti. But beyond this slight difference, no matter which one we feel inclined to, in both cases, the four belong to Mishra Bhakti. And of course, the two of them, both Krishnadas Kaviraj and Baladev, also agree that such people who approach bhakti with a particular desire, whether it may be, again, dharma, artha, kama, moksha, if you want to call them like that, they will gradually, by bhakti's own grace, shelter, and contact, become purified from material desires, from any separate interest, and eventually attain a platform of Uttam Bhakti, and will engage in, or Sudha Bhakti, as we call, pure devotion, unmixed devotion. And the critical point here is, after receiving the grace of Krishna or his devotees, not by their own personal effort, because by one's own personal conception, we can just maximum want to stop suffering and approach a God with that, our own desire, at hand. But we need, again, the contact with the higher plane, higher realm, to attain something beyond that, if you will. So, and again, this verse speaks about Sukriti. There are different types of Sukriti, or piety, or credit, if you will, merit. If you have Karma Sukriti, Jnana Sukriti, and of course, Bhakti Sukriti. So, we know how, in which direction all the things are taking different people, basically. So Krishna here in this verse is generally describing like pious souls in general, who are somehow engaged in the context of Varnashram, as we know, the socio-religious system that is prescribed in Shastra, and that who will approach Krishna, as my Gurmash will say in his commentary, in their hour of necessity. Not necessarily they are approaching Krishna at every single moment in Krishna's own hour of necessity. Because our own hour of necessity is basically a joke in comparison to the real necessities that arise out of love, out of the loving life that Krishna is having with his associate. There are real necessities. When we really start to love, when we learn to love, the closer we get to that reality, we will realize, oh my God, what I thought it was suffering, it's nothing compared to the suffering that comes in love. But it's a comprehensive suffering that includes ananda in itself. What I was suffering was totally empty, was totally miserable. That's not real suffering. And the same with everything. Necessity. I think I have so many necessities. But if they are not aligned with the real necessity, the real artha, purusartha, the ultimate purusartha, prem, divine love, there how much of an emergency that is, as we spoke the other day. We're running here and there are so many paying so much attention to what we think it's an emergency, it's so important, it's a priority. But we have to gradually be educated about real priorities in life, real priorities in eternity. We can have temporary priorities, but which is the eternal priority? It has been, it is, and it will be always the topmost priority for me as who I really am, as all that I can be regarding the potential of the jiva. So, what else? In this verse, okay, these four types of people also are... If there is a gradation, yeah, it is mentioned that the lowest of them all is the one who approaches Krishna for wealth. That's what the commentators are saying. Give me money, God. I want to enjoy, please bless me with that. And from there you can go gradually to the other ones. No, the distressed, who is the one who maybe after asking the money and spending that wrongly is experiencing the miseries of that, that's the distressed. Now he or she will approach God with another perspective, not so much give me money so I enjoy or whatever, but please, I'm suffering because of what I requested from you previously and how I dealt with that. Now I'm distressed, relieve me from the distress. A way to put it. And then maybe the inquisitive. Okay, I've asked for that, now I have peace, but it's peace all. Someone will inquire more philosophically, and eventually those who have knowledge will have a more accurate perspective. No, and they will shoot in a more accurate direction. So some examples that are mentioned in Shastra of these different types of people are Dhruva Maharaj, for Artharthi. I won't enter into the details of the story of each one, but as you know, Dhruva Maharaj as a child, he wanted to have a kingdom even more opulent than that of his father Uttanapa, because he was kind of rejected by him when his mother Suniti was co-wife with Suruchi, and Suruchi had a son, and Suruchi was the favorite of the king. So one day the son of Suruchi was on her lap, and Dhruva wanted also to go to the lap of her co-mother, and the mother said, go down here, you don't have the adhikar to be in my lap, I'm the king's favorite, and you are just the son of the non-favorite one, and things like this. And the king Uttanapada was seeing that and didn't say anything because of his partiality towards Suruchi. So then Dhruva in anger wanted to leave the kingdom and obtain a kingdom far away more bigger than that of his father. And he spoke with Suniti, he received some advice, and Suniti advised, surrender to Bhagavan, worship him, meditate in him, he will for sure fulfill all your desires. So, as you know, Dhruva is a child, goes to the forest and eventually meditates very seriously, very intensely. He has darshan of Bhagavan, and when he experiences that, he realizes, oh my God, what I was looking for, he mentions in a famous verse, was I thought it was the all in all, and now that I see you, now that I enter in touch with you, I realize it was just like a broken piece of glass. Eventually he receives the kingdom and so on, but he becomes totally converted and transformed by engaging in bhakti. So again, he approached Krishna for wealth, Artharthi, but the end result of that approach was not only wealth, but the real wealth. So there's a happy end to this story of Dhruva Maharaj that you can see in more detail in chapter 4 of the Bhagavatam. Another example, the example of Artharthi, the distressed, is Gajendra, which again is a famous section in the Bhagavatam, it's the 8th canto. Gajendra is king of elephants, who was in Dradyumna Maharaj in his previous lifetime, and again, he's bitten by a crocodile, and all his family members, he was enjoying with their family members on a lake, like a royal elephant, having like heavenly standard of enjoyment and so on. But suddenly the crocodile starts to bite his leg, and he's on the water, so it's the crocodile stage, he's stronger there, and eventually he starts to die, almost. And the family members disappear, and Gajendra, the elephant, by being a very pious personality in his previous life as a king, a devotee, he remembers his previous life, starts to pray to Bhagavan in affliction, being distressed. and offer some prayers, and Bhagavan comes and he's safe, happy, and again. So again, he approaches Bhagavan in distress, but the end result is more than relief from distress. Again, then Saunaka Rishi is the example of the inquisitive. We can see him in a group of the sages in Saimnamisaranya, who is approaching Suta Goswami, inquiring from him and so on. And eventually, of course, like hearing the Bhagavatam, whatever level of inquiry he started with becomes totally upgraded. And finally, the Gyanis, or those in knowledge, are the example given generally is the four Kumars, Chatusan Kumar, who again also are depicted in the Bhagavatam as Gyanis or Gyan Mishra Bhaktas, and becoming converted, not only by, one need to say, by smelling the fragrance of Tulsi, but by witnessing the particular exchange that Bhagavan himself has with Jaya and Vijaya when the Kumars cursed him to fall, and how Bhagavan reacts in that moment, and they realize what's the position of Bhakti, what's the position of Jaya Vijaya, the Bhaktas, how Bhagavan himself is taking all the responsibility for whatever his devotees did, and the Gyanis are, the Kumars are very wise people, so they realize, wow, I mean, these devotees are all in all for Bhagavan. He's taking full responsibility for, he loves them so much. So what's the potency of Bhakti to capture Bhagavan in such a way? Nasada yati mam jogo, nasankhyam dharma udava, nasadhyaya stapasta go, jato bhaktir mamarjita, says Krishna in the Uddhava Gita. I am not controlled by Sankhya, by Dharma, but study of the scripture by tapasya, as I am controlled fully by Bhakti. So that's a real moment of conversion of the Kumars. I think we will be speaking more in detail about this nice section for Narasimha Chaturdasi in a few months. So again, at the end I ended up telling a little bit the story of each one. But basically that's the idea. Somehow, here we are finding these four types of people. Again, there is people with distress, there's people who has affliction, but who are not approaching Bhakti, who are not on the path that includes Bhakti, so they may not attain Bhakti, they may attain the respective goals. Someone may want wealth, and they engage in karmakandas, some may want whatever else, some other thing, and they will end up in somewhere else. But those on a path in which Bhakti comes to predominate are the ones discussed in this verse. And ultimately, these four types of people, by approaching Bhakti, they ultimately will attain Bhakti. Baladev Vidya Bhushan mentions also that those who desire wealth in this verse, and those who are in distress, the lowest type, if you will, eventually will become inquisitive, and inquisitive eventually will attain knowledge, will become a jnani. What I mentioned before, so there you have some sort of hierarchy, you know, that's like the natural progression, that even we can see that in ourselves generally. So as knowledge develops, devotion starts to manifest, material desire starts to wane, if you will. As my Guru Maharaj puts in his comment, devotion wakes, and material desire wanes, while knowledge develops in the context of Bhakti. And of course, the best of these four will be then the Jnani, who is already acknowledged. Krishna will confirm that in the next verse of the Gita, so of course we won't go in that direction. So some words regarding, that's the first part of the question. Let me say something else regarding the last part, which mentions which is asking about karma. The desire for the cessation of something seems inherently negative compared to the desire for something positive. So is this the kind of karma acquired with respect to the four legs of Dharma better in setting up a foundation for Bhakti to grow from? Or should we understand all karma to be inherently binding and therefore equally negative? Or in some way that the bad karma that manifests in loss, in destruction, in unhappiness and in pain is actually good, in that it more quickly cuts through the illusion of safety or satisfaction in the world? Well, all these questions cannot be replied in one single way, because every single person is in a different stage, situation, environment. So they may be going through the same situation externally, but since internally they are in very different worldviews, if you will, constellations, they will deal with the situation very different. So you may say, okay, is suffering something favorable, bad karma, if you will, because you will more quickly cut delusion? Depends. If you are able to learn from that, okay, but for some people, they will continue in that direction, or even worse, and even worse, and even worse, if they are not open to learn at that particular moment for some particular reason. So, regarding what comes from the four regulative principles or legs of Dharma, I wouldn't call that karma. Of course, it's a form of, it's not inherently bhakti, as we already discussed in previous lectures, but if we are speaking about the devotee, so again, you have to have the context, which is the specific case, but for a devotee, probably maybe we have been touched by bhakti first, and then we knew about, for example, the four regulative principles. Of course, there may be devotees who are already following that, and they were having a pious, sattvic form of life, which of course, in Shastras mentioned, it may, sattva is characterized by clarity, intelligibility. So that may be helpful in the sense of grasping what's beyond sattva. But again, it all very different things can happen. Krishna the Gita says, if you reach sattva and you get attached to remaining in sattva, then you fall to rajas, because attachment is a sign of rajas, not of sattva. Sattva is just like the platform, as we say the other day, like you go to the airport, you reach sattva, but to take the plane and go somewhere, that's another thing. You have to go beyond sattva, you have to leave the airport behind. So, but again, bhakti is independent. So we see so many examples in Shastra that bhakti is coming to even animals, to babies, to old people, to people of different races and genders and species. So it's independent. It doesn't wait for, okay, you follow the four regs and only then you can have bhakti. Bhakti comes first and then all the other things go away. Like the very the false shruti of the Rasa Lila, Rasa Panchadhyaya is mentioned. Vikriditam brajava dubididancha vishnu sadambitanu shrinadala tavarna yetat bhaktim param bhagavati pratilabhya kamam hridrogam asuva pahinatya chirena dhira. So by hearing, properly hearing, in the proper context, this katha of Krishna with the gopis, one will attain the highest form of bhakti and the sickness of the heart, if you will, hridrog, which is calm or selfish desire, will be totally dissipated. One will become dhira. You will become a sober person. So bhakti is entering and creating all this. It's not that I have to create everything else and then bhakti. No, that's a wrong conception of bhakti. That's a conception of bhakti tinged with karma or jnana. No, I need to do this and this for bhakti to be more effective. Bhakti, again, is independent. So bhakti can come to jagai madai, if you will. Bhakti can come to so many terrible personalities. But again, as a rule, we can say exceptions and rules, but as a rule, as a general situation, yeah, it's recommended if someone is more pious, more close to sattva, more following a lifestyle that resembles on some level what the lifestyle of the bhakta is, that may help those people to easily, with more capacity, if you will, grasp what bhakti is about, what's beyond their own situation. But again, there has to be some sincerity of heart. Because again, you can be in sattva and eventually be downplaying from that and so on. So regarding how, just to finish my question and try to say something about regarding now Rasa's question, I see there's another question by Carolina as well. I don't know if I will be able to address all of them. How Krishna deals with the devotee, or how a devotee should deal with so-called bad karma in his life. Again, according to Vishwanath, there is only good Sukriti, Bhakti Sukriti, if you will, or mercy, or Bhakti interacting, the surrender devotee. And again, a devotee is as much as one is surrender. As much as you surrender to Guru, Vaishnav, to Bhakti itself, you are a Bhakta. It's not black and white. So when the scripture speaks about a devotee has no longer karma, that's true. As much as you are a devotee, you have no longer karma. The non-devotee part that remains there, that's another thing. But the devotee's part, if you will, there's no karma if you really embrace bhakti. So Krishna says, Yasya amanugrinami haristi tattanam shanai. If I want to really favor something, I gradually deprive that person of all their wealth, he says. And of course, with this he's meaning, from all that person is attached to, from all that person is thinking it is wealth. Because, I don't know, Yudhishthira Maharaj had so much wealth, but he was not attached to that. He was attached to using that for Krishna's pleasure. Or sometimes a devotee, in connection with the other verse, a devotee may be praying to Krishna for something which is not the higher thing, but Krishna wants to favor that devotee. Again, there are so many levels of devotee. So in the fifth canto, we find that. In the fifth canto, I think, chapter 19, Krishna says, Satyam, Dishati, Artitam, Artito, Ninnam. There we find words like Artar, Naibartado, Jatpunar, Artita, Jataha, again, Artita, Sayam, Vidate, Bhajatam, Manichatam, Ichapidanam, Nijapada, Palavam. So, in this verse it says that Bhagavan, it's another verse connected to the other ones who even further qualifies that. Bhagavan is fulfilling the material desires of a devotee who approaches him with such motives. Again, the ones described in the 7th chapter of the Gita. But, the Bhagavatam is saying, he is not blessing or bestowing benedictions upon the devotee in such a way that those blessings will cause the devotee to demand more benedictions again, of that level, of that type. However, what does Bhagavan do in those moments? He satisfies whatever they need, but in such a way that next time they will ask for a higher blessing, and a higher blessing, until they realize the giver of the blessing is the blessing itself. To serve him is the blessing, the ultimate benediction. And that's what the Bhagavatam says here. However, ultimately, Bhagavan will give the devotee shelter at his own lotus feet. Even though such a person is not aspiring for it in day one, but that shelter will satisfy all desires. And that's the special mercy of Bhagavan. So, God is acting on us in very secret way, very invisible ways also. Sometimes it is said that Krishna is acting in our lives secretly, invisibly, without us noticing what he's actually doing. Because if we will know, probably we will run away from that. Because at present we are not fully willing to accept his shelter, all the implications of his shelter and so on. We will try to take advantage of that in a selfish way. We will misread, misinterpret his mercy on us, and we will try to exploit that. So that's why sometimes they say God is acting in a very subtle, basically, invisible ways, if you will. So again, some thoughts is not the all-in-all of what we can say. There were many things implied in the question. There were many questions in the question. But I want to share some words at least. And I will go, I think I will have to finish very briefly with your permission now, Rasa Prabhu, your question. Then we can continue exploring more. He's asking if we could kindly say something about Tulasi Tattva. So, yes, we can say something. Indeed, I remember some years ago we made a seminar on Tulsi Tattva, which unfortunately you won't be able to follow because it's in Spanish. But eventually we can do something in English as well. So, Tulsi Tattva. Sorry. So, of course, we worship Tulsi Devi on a daily basis. It's so crucial for us. We mentioned something about the conversion of the Kumars. In Gaur Lila, we have a Baitacharya inviting Mahaprabhu to descend and recite, offering Tulsi and Ganga Jal to Shalagram, reciting this verse which says how by a little bit of Tulsi Patra, Bhagavan is invited to this and is captured completely. And as we know in Govardhan Leela also, they were feeding Krishna's Govardhan, manifesting, and he was saying, Anayor, Anayor, give me more, And the Brajavasis didn't know what to do. And eventually the inspiration comes. Let's give him a leaf of tulsi. He became totally satisfied. Ah, santusta, full satisfaction there. So in this way, there are so many verses in Shastra that praise the position of tulsi. Sometimes tulsi is depicted also with four arms in connection to Vaikuntha. Apart as a plant, as we know her on here on planet Earth, but as we know, all these forms are the expansion of Srimati Brindadevi, who resides in Golok Vrindavan. And Brindadevi, of course, as we know, she's a dutika. She operates as a messenger in the dynamics of the lila. She's one of the main orchestrators there, and it's important to speak about Brindadevi because ultimately, the converging point of Tulsi Tattva is Golok Vrindavan, and there we will find her in that identity. Although a second converging point for us is Gaur Lila Nityanavadvip, and there everyone is on a sadhaka platform, perfected sadhakas, and again Tulsi manifests there as a plant, and is taking part of all the offerings and so on. But in the direction of Vrindavan, yes, she is Brindadevi, Lila Shakti of the whole Braj, and this energy that again is allowing the Lila to take place, creating all different nuances and dynamics. She's closely associated also ontologically with Purnamasi Yogamaya, but in arranging all different affairs of the Lila. So we could say it's an aspect of Tulsi Devi or Brindadevi specifically here, is an aspect of an expression of Yogamaya, an expression of the Sarup Shakti. And it is mentioned that each plant that we have here on earth, each plant of Tulsi, is an expression of this Shakti as well. Tulsi is not to be considered as Jiva Shakti, as Tatasta Shakti, but as an expression of Swarup Shakti, coming to bless us here, as Tatasta Jivas here. According to Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, Tulsi Maharani is considered an expansion of the, because the internal potency of Bhagavan also has many subdivisions, if you will, divisions and subdivisions. Jiva Goswami quotes this in the Sandarbhas, and Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur mentions that Tulsi Devi is an expansion of the internal potency of Krishna called Urja. And you may know the word Urja in connection with Kartik, which is called sometimes Urja Brata, which is connected with Sri Radha, who is called Urjeshwari. Urjeshwari. Urja, the word Urja means resource, interestingly. So Urja Shakti means the potency, the resourceful potency, the potency that creates resources, that arranges, that allow things to happen. Sri Radha is Urjeshwari, the queen of all resources. This is very charming if you play out the implications of all the things. How she's always allowing everything to happen. So again, Tulsi Devi is Shakti Tattva, Bhakti Shakti Tattva, Sarup Shakti Tattva, like so many other transcendental items. So again, we cannot maybe at present see with our own eyes the personification of Brindadevi and interact in service with her. She's a transcendental entity, but she has come again in this world in the form of Tulsi Devi, that not only we can see, but we can serve and worship in so many ways. And there are different types of worship that we can perform to Srimati Tulsi Maharani. So it's important when we have Tulsi, remember that. This is Brindadevi herself coming to bless my life in the form of a plant, if you will, in a very user-friendly form that I can hand in my particular condition as Krishna. Srila Prabhupada says, speaking about the deity, Krishna's, the deity is Krishna in a form that you can handle, he will say. He descends, he manifests so you can engage in his service. If not, it will be too much beyond you, yourself. So something similar we could say, Brindadevi, it's a deity. The plant is a deity in itself that we worship, that we pray to, that we sing to, that we take care of, and we dress and so on. We feed by watering it. So again, we are seeing a plant, but we should remember, it's not a plant. It can remove all obstacles. It can bestow Bhakti Devi. It can give mercy. May qualify us to serve Sri Radha Krishna. So there are many verses in Shastra that are saying this. How is this verse? Sahaja madura radha krishna tipranuraga prasala muhurudancha charu romancha punja pratipada paribridha nanda shinda vagade pratimuhurati matutfuli tangamma anya mini. No, this is not the one. Ini nidabasa basala salalam bapado gunavati tava nata nati tum jamturesa sapadi babadanuk yayachate devi brinde mayi kira karo nardram drishti matra prasidha. So that Srimati Brinda Devi is described. Oh, you are so merciful. You are so qualified. Made me qualified for the service of Sri Sri Radha and Krishna. Your whole body is melting with mercy. Your whole identity is melting with the mercy you have. So please bestow some mercy on me. And so on. So there are hundreds of verses, again, that are glorifying Tulsi. For example, in the Sanatana Goswami Hari Bhakti Vilas, you will find a lot of them. In Padma Purana, it is mentioned, for example, all the pilgrimage places of the planet, and not only this planet, but in millions of universes, take shelter in one single leaf of Srimati Tulsi Devi. So, again, it's a way of, for us, helping us to approach a proper conceptual orientation. And there are different, of course, lilas in which Tulsi is taking part. Some of them I already mentioned, but many, many other are there. And Krishna, of course, we put Tulsi in every offering. And to say there is not, Krishna is not us accepting an offering that does not contain Tulsi. Chandrasekhar is saying something similar. Chapana bhoga, chatrisya vyanjana. You know the song, Vina tulasi pravakana ahimani. Namo namo tulasi maharani, brindi maharani, namo namaha. So Bhagavan is not having even the least interest for chapan bhoga, for all these 56 or whatever offerings are different quantities of things. Bina tulasi, prabhu eka nahi mani. Prabhu is not attracted if bina tulasi fits without tulsi, no matter how big the whole thing is. Even sometimes it's so important, the presence of tulsi. For example, in Bhaya Purana it is mentioned that if on some emergency day you don't have available any leaves of tulsi, it is say, if you cannot get these tulsi leaves, at least you can get the wood of tulsi, so to put that nearby Bhagavan. And even if you can get tulsi wood, at least you should chant the name of tulsi while you're worshipping Hari. Somehow or other, you invoke her presence in those crucial moments, basically. Also, something very interesting that comes to mind, that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions, that tulsi, although it's very exalted for us, especially Vaishnavas, generally is not considered among other plants a very like fragrant plant. It's not maybe famous for its aroma, if you will. But Thakur Vishwanath Chakravarti mentions that in the morning, tulsi emits a very transcendental fragrance that ordinary people cannot perceive, but transcendental personalities fully appreciate. So if you want to measure your adhikar in bhakti, you go in the morning and try to see if you can connect with that transcendental fragrance. If that's not happening, okay, that's telling something about you. So there is something that happens at that moment of the day specifically. So again, some ideas, some ideas that we can share about the Shastra. And again, how Advaita Acharya called Mahaprabhu, that's a very important way, because the psychology of Advaita, going back again to this famous Bhartula Sadana Matrina Jalasya Chulukina and so on, Vikrinite Sanatmanam Bhakti Vyo Bhakta Vatsala. Krishna is described as Bhakta Vatsala, the one who loves his devotees. So since that's his nature, that's his favorite quality in himself, through Krishna Karshini Chasat, he becomes attracted by his devotee, Ham Bhakta Parad, you know. He gives himself to someone who is offering simply, again, Tulasi Dalla Matrina, one leaf of tulsi, Jalasi Chulukye Nava, and one palm full of water. That's what Advaita Acharya said. Vikrinite Swanatmanam. Swanatmana, he gives his own self to the devotee. So Advaita thought, okay, so Krishna has such a debt with someone who is offering Tulsi and Jal in this way. Krishna became so indebted that he's thinking, I mean, I don't have any wealth myself. That's Krishna's humility and Krishna's greatness and Krishna's charm. He's like, in his psychology, Bhagavan, he's thinking, I mean, this person have offered to me Tulsi. I mean, there is no wealth I possess. And he has wealth. He's Bhagavan. But in comparison to that, he feels, she's offering Tulsi with bhakti. I don't have a way of repaying that. I don't have wealth that can compare with that. So I have to give myself to that person. I don't have anything I can give. I will give myself, even though I feel by giving myself it's not enough yet to pay the debt, but I have to do something. So it's a very similar dynamic to what Krishna says in other sections of Shastra, Yat Mam Prapadyante or Napariham Nirabhadyasan, speaking about how he reciprocates with his devotees. So it is said, if you want Krishna Prem, if you really want what Mahaprabhu came to give, that type of Prem, you should approach Tulsi as Advaita Acharya approached Tulsi, and through which approach Bhagavan himself. So you try to serve Tulsi Devi in the same way as Advaita Acharya did. Now, with that awareness, by doing that, by offering her to Bhagavan, what's the result? What's the effect of Tulsi in Krishna? And which will be the blessing received by that. So in this very important moment, again, this is a very crucial section for our Sampradaya, the moment when Advaita Acharya is invoking this, he's establishing the Siddhanta, if you will, of Tulsi Tattva, how to approach Tulsi, and how to make proper progress in bhakti, in the service of Bhagavan. Chaitanya Bhagavat, similarly, just some few words because we are getting close to the end. When Chaitanya Bhagavat is mentioned that Mahaprabhu's disciples will also keep a Tulsi tree behind, or Tulsi plant behind Mahaprabhu. And so Mahaprabhu will sit, take darshan of Srimati Tulsi Devi, and chant his prescribed number of rounds there. So that's when also the tradition of chanting in front of Tulsi came. That's part of the tradition, if you will, in us. Mahaprabhu used to say there in Chaitanya Bhagavat, say, just as a fish cannot live without water, I cannot remain alive in separation of Tulsi Maharani. You can imagine. No? I mean, he's not just saying it. He really means that. So that's why the service of Sant Devotee was carrying Tulsi wherever Mahaprabhu will appear. You want Mahaprabhu to remain alive. So better you keep Tulsi next, close to him. So he will chant his rounds next to Tulsi with that feeling. Again, try to imagine a fish out of water. What's that? I mean, the only thing a fish is thinking is water, 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 outside of water. So Mahaprabhu is just thinking Tulsi, 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 Tulsi. So again, why Tulsi is so important? Just to finish with this and make full circle, let's go back for a minute to Vrindadevi. And the role of Vrindadevi that is so dear to Krishna as a orchestrator, as a dutika, as a messenger, as giving instruction to the birds, to the peacocks, to make an arrangement for the nikunjas, to the flowers, to special fragrances to manifest in a particular way, a particular season, all related to this nikunja seva, specifically to singa rasa, more specifically, and serving Sri Radha and Krishna. In this way, making an arrangement for the two of them to meet in Abhisar eventually, serving Sri Radha particularly, but creating the perfect environment again. So the two of them, actually, both Radha and Krishna, are controlled by Vrindadevi, by the degree of her service, by their surrender. They depend on her in the context of the Leela. They are controlled by her, by the love she's expressing to them, but also they depend on her, they need her to make the proper arrangement, because in the dynamic of the Leela, Radha and Krishna need so many other people for their meeting to succeed, basically. They're kind of just the two of them just run and meet each other here and there in Vrindavan. It cannot happen. It's parakia. It's illegal, if you will. It's in the black market. It's clandestine. So that's the idea. So the point is, we approach, knowing she's so dear to them, if we want to attain Sri Radha and Krishna, ultimately the service of them in one way or another, as in Manjari Bhav, Priyanama Sakya, whatever, the main current of our soul, you know, oh, this Tulsi Devi, who is Brinda Devi, this is so dear to Radha and Krishna. Radha and Krishna are so willing to reciprocate in service with her. So we can approach Tulsi Devi, please be merciful with me. And Tulsi will interact, will be in between and say, please, Radha and Krishna, be merciful with this particular jiva, this devotee, make them qualified to engage in service. And Sri Radha and Krishna will obey immediately. And that's what we sing on a daily basis in the morning. If you, I mean, I don't want to go into the details of the Tulsi Kirtan we sing on every single morning. But basically that's the idea there. You're asking, give me Adhikar for Bhakti. Make me a Brajavasi. By your mercy I may become a Brajavasi. More ayabi, less bilas kunja diubas. I would like to serve in Nikunja. And so on. Aini Vedana Dara Sakirana Gata Koro. Seva Adi Karadiya Karadiyava Karaniyavasi. So Seva Adi Kardiya. Give me Seva Adi Kar. Qualify me to engage in Seva. And not Seva in a generic way again. But in a very specific realm, situation, dynamic. So many things are going on there. So again, so many other things we could say, but to be honest, I have to do some things today, as I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture, so we have some nice reason to continue. Tulsi Katha, Srimati Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Srimati Brinda Devi Ki Jai. So one more time I remind all of you, in case you were not connected before, that this will be the last Ishtagosti for some time, because in some days I'm traveling to the US. And of course, as you may know, also you are invited in a few days. On Tuesday, I will be doing officially book launch of my first book, Bhakti in the Jiva, Inherent or Inherited Bhakti in the Jiva and Gaudiya Vedanta. On Tuesday, I have been shared some flyer of that, so hopefully we can see you there. And after that, I will be having like a tour for like 3 months or something in the US, giving some lectures. So actually, we'll have a much many lectures in English with Q&As included. So I won't be doing the weekly Q&A for some time. I will be starting some Spanish Q&A to compensate with the Spanish-speaking audience and try to serve all of you some way or another. So that's all. Hope to see you soon somewhere or another, soon or Zoom. And thank you so much for your presence and questions and support and affection. Srila Gurudev Ki Jai. Shriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Shri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanda Haribo.